I was always amused that they said that we weren't allowed there because we were too noisy and polluting. I don't know whether many of your listeners have ever visited Manhattan, but I found that weird.
It is weird.
That is weird. If you've ever been to Manhattan, you know what we're talking about. It's permanent gridlock, and there's automobile exhaust and people and cars and trucks and diesels and everything just everywhere. It is amazing how much they can pack into that tiny little island. We certainly got our money's worth when we bought it.
I guess as flight crews, you sort of just gave up trying to acclimate to the local time zones.
It wasn't too bad because we I just did that in night services because I hate getting up in the morning. So we'd leave London at 7, get to New York at in the evening, get to New York at 6, have a couple of beers, get up the next morning. And we, because of the local time changes, it was just fantastic. You could have a real good lie-in, you get up, get on the airplane, get back into UK at about 10 o'clock at night. So really, and they paid us to do this. This is the extraordinary thing.
So that's one of the best-kept secrets right there, yeah.
Now, let me ask you this. This is a very technical question here. While you're buzzing along on autopilot there at 60,000 feet, Mach 2.02, did you ever look at the guy next to you and say, wow, isn't this cool?
Oh, I'm sure that happened.
I think pretty well all the time.
I think pretty well all the time we looked at that. Yes. Well, depending on who the guy next to you was, I suppose. But you know, sometimes maybe not. But, you know. But yeah. Yeah, I mean, this was what an amazing world when we were doing this. Until we came along, the only people who'd flown supersonic had worn silver pressure suits, bone domes, and had to go to the washroom in a tube somewhere. And we were there in suits. I mean, we couldn't give our passengers bone domes and silver suits. Well, anyway, if we did, they'd all be taken home as souvenirs, so we'd never have any left. But we were sitting, people were sitting there, you were sitting there in shirt sleeves, drinking a little champagne.
That's right.
Eating a little caviar. And the only people higher than you, further away from the world than you, would have been the occasional astronauts. And there were more, by the way, shuttle astronauts than there were Concorde pilots.
Jeez, that's amazing.
You are
one
select.
Interesting story that came out on the right at the beginning. Colin Marshall, as he was then, he's now Lord Marshall, but he was our chief executive in British Airways for under Lord King. He did the second trip out from Washington on the Air France aeroplane, and sitting next to him was a lady who'd bought a ticket to do this service, and he was quite surprised that after her meal, she opened her handbag and she tipped all the cutlery, the tray, the knives, forks, spoons, and everything into a bag. You know, and then he just looked at her and she said, well, souvenir, you know, I bought the ticket. She said to him, have you finished with yours? He said, yes. So she leant across and she took it and put it into the bag. And he tells that as a story at dinners.
I guess he just didn't know what to do. Well, we're going to take a quick break again and we'll be right back with the Concorde crew. This is Digital Dave.
And I'm Fast Eddie.
And we're back. This is Digital Dave. This indeed is EAA Radio.
Oh, man. Are we having 12:10
a.m.
this morning?
93.1 FM.
And, of course, on the internet at airventure.org.
/radio. Probably.
And if you're listening to us on the internet, please take the time to send us an email. Let us know what you think. In the meantime, we have five gentlemen here who came across the pond.
And I'll bet they were pissed because it was subsonic.
Probably. These
took
guys
took them forever to get here.
Yeah, they're thinking, come on, guys, let's get some gas together. Let's get a Concorde and let's buzz on over to Oshkosh.
The transition from subsonic to supersonic. I mean, we always say sound barrier, you know, but it was really like a non-event, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. In the old days, you remember the old films where you see the old aeroplanes shaking themselves to pieces. Well, nowadays it doesn't happen that way. And it just, as you slide through the sound barrier, the only indication you have up front on the flight deck is on the pressure instruments, a slight blip, and that is it. In the cabin, there was we eventually put in a monitor so that people could see Mach 1, Mach 2. Just as an aside, one of the particular pilots, Stack Butterley, on the charters, we used to do a lot of charter flights, you know, 100-minute flights to go Mach 2 and back down on the ground again with 100 passengers. Stack would talk to the passengers as we went through Mach 1. He'd say, we're now just approaching Mach 1. Here we're going through the sound barrier. And he'd hand fly it, and he'd shake the controls backwards and forwards. So and then when we got through all
just to give him a little thrill.
Oh, geez. I can't imagine showing up at an airport in something like this. You guys must have been treated like celebrities.
Well, especially
you
here.
I think people did, but the rest of the crews didn't like us very much because I think they got the impression we thought we were rather special. And so, that sort of upset him a bit, I guess, because we were.
I like how he said that, rather yeah. special.
Yeah. And one of his compadres there said, so.
Yeah.
One example I saw, you're probably familiar with the Royal Air Force's Red Arrows display team.
Never seen them here. Why don't you guys bring them with
well,
you?
I say they're the best in the world, but I'd say that, wouldn't I? So let's not get into that.
I was going to say, put them all in an A380. Yeah. And the airplanes,
and the
too.
Airplanes. But they go around the world. They're a magnificent display team. They work really hard. Their routine is about half an hour long, and they really work their butts off to get a good display. And at Farnborough, the big air show there, they would do their display, and everybody, all the corporate customers would sit drinking coffee, drinking their champagne, occasionally glancing at all this magnificent flying going on. And we turned up and we just did a fly past at 200 feet and everybody came out from their lunches to have a look at us. And that really annoyed the Red Arrows pilots. They said all the work that we put on and we just did a go around.
That's right.
Yeah. Isn't that scary? They got upstaged by the Concorde. Guys, I got to tell you, are there any plans to put together another supersonic airliner?
Yeah, they're going to refit that A380 with some rocket engines.
I don't think so. I've done a bit of work with Boeing on their supersonic transport. And the airplane, which is in the simulator, the vertical motion simulator at NASA Ames, and the airplane flew absolutely beautifully. And we were just doing approaches and landings. But one of the things they had was that you couldn't see out of it. You just had a television screen of the runway you're going to. So you do your landings completely blind, and it worked just fine because instead of raining and being a horrid day, every day was sunny and no rain. So it made the whole thing real a lot easier.
I don't know. It sounds like it's trying to take the thrill out of it, though.
Yeah, no kidding.
In answer to your question, like Norman, I've done some work with some of the manufacturers in Europe and Japan and over here in the States. If the next generation, if it's going to work, to be serious for a minute, has got to be, and I hope it will, has got to be maybe 350-seater. It's got to be trans-Pacific. It's got to be maybe 2.5 max, something like that, with the range, the ability to fly subsonic, if necessary, be economical, all those things.
Just a small...
It's a whole new aeroplane. It's a whole new aeroplane. But it would look... Every company I went and spoke to when I was still with British Airways, I had a job where I went around discussing it with some of these people. Everybody gave me a model of what they thought the next supersonic would look like, and every one of them looked like Concorde. Some changes to it. So I think it suggests that we got the design right 60 years ago.
Well, that's for sure. The Russians copied it. And, of course, it was called the Concordsky, the Tu-144. Did any of you guys ever get the chance to actually get on one of these things and just take a walk about on it?
Oh, I bet they wouldn't set foot near it. You stole one once?
Well, no, in 91, I was organizing things for the Concorde's social. I was known as the adjutant. I was a socializer. For all the things. I went to Moscow to find a Concorde pilot, ended up with a general instead to come and talk to us. But I went to Monino, their secret, as it was in the early days, their secret museum, where every aircraft that Russians build, they build one and stick it in a museum. And there's a Concordsky there as well. They had the seats, the steps up for us the day before, and unfortunately we turned up one day later, so we didn't get a chance to go on board. But it's a very sad-looking aeroplane sitting in that park all on its own.
Sad because it's so lonely, or sad?
Well, I think we have to give them credit. They did their first flight on the 31st of December, 1968. We were then in 69 from the French one, and April for our one. They did everything about 3 months or so ahead of us. The only problem was they got the intake design wrong. They had to use afterburner the whole time to go supersonic. They were burning out the engine. They didn't have the range, and the whole thing was a disaster.
They also had various aerodynamic problems, and from what I understand, it was also a maintenance pig as well.
Well, Dave will tell you about the maintenance, but there is a lot of maintenance on the aeroplane. Oh, well, he won't do. Oh no, I know nothing. one of our engineers, Ricky Baston, was telling us there's something about 40 to 50 hours maintenance for every hour of flight, something like that. So it's much higher than any other aeroplane.
How much maintenance per flying hour did you guys have to do on the Concorde?
Or was that the Concorde?
Or was there maintenance?
No, they didn't. They didn't fix anything.
There was certainly maintenance, but a heck of a lot of it. I can't remember the hours.
Oh, okay.
It was a bit more than the regular subsonic airplanes, and they flew a bit less. So it was a costly exercise doing the maintenance. I had some responsibility at one stage for the sort of financial bottom line and things like that. And the biggest item was maintenance.
Well, did you guys?
The second biggest was fuel.
Did you guys ever have an airplane grounded for maintenance where you had to fly somebody over with parts or something to get the aircraft back in the air again?
I'll let Dave think about that for a minute. He was the boss of flight engineering on the fleet for a while. But from my point of view, yes, because unlike Boeings and Airbuses, where it's like Fords and Chevys, there are spare parts all over the world. And so when something goes, you go to a store and you get the part. There weren't many Concorde spares around. Some of them are common to all sorts of aircraft, but many are very special. So you'd have to delay while a special part was sent and probably a special qualified engineer to do it as well. But we used to build that in. And our regular destinations always kept stores, always kept qualified engineers. So it's when you went somewhere unusual or very special, like here, for instance, at Oshkosh, you'd have to make sure you took some spares with you and a qualified engineer and things like that.
Well, you'd have no shortage of people that would want to help.
That's for sure.
No, that wasn't a problem. But, we had one or two little problems. I have a photograph at home in an album of one of our Concords at New York taxiing out. And the top rudder section, the two rudders, top and the bottom, and the top one has got the Air France colours on.
Oops.
Now, we went in for pooling. No, there's no point of us having a shed full of spares in New York and Air France similarly. So we pooled. No, you have that bit, I'll have this bit. And they had a rudder, and so there it was. We also developed a series of things we called World Air Cruisers, 3 to 4 weeks. I seem to remember about 1990, the ticket price was about $45,000. But for that, you got your own Concorde, your own crew, 4 weeks, and magnificent destinations. So we put a few spares in the back of that, things that we thought might be needed. But
extra peanuts, cups.
Yes, napkins, those two. And pitot tubes have been in the headlines recently, and we got a call from Bali, I think it was, that the pitot heater had gone.
That's an important one.
That's an important one, yes. So we looked how to get one out quickest, but the magic about Concorde is that you accelerate and you climb very rapidly. So we agreed that they would shoot up through the subsonic levels, and if moisture got in and froze up, they'd then switch to the alternative one, that long spiky thing on the nose. And then, of course, as soon as you got supersonic and the temperature build up, that little bit of ice started to melt again, so you could go back to normal service.
Okay, that's just cheating.
Yeah, I know. We ran a very friendly sort of organization. The quickest way to get the replacement out was for one of the hangar engineers to sign it out on his personal tool check. He passed it on to me. I passed it on to the crew who are going to take over the airplane. He put it in his suitcase, and it ended up in, I think, Bahrain for changing.
Wow.
Wow.
Slightly back channel there.
I'll tell you, guys, it's a shame because I get the feeling that we could sit here and shoot the breeze about Concorde stories all day.
Well, we have to let them go, but they are doing a couple of shows today, right?
Yes.
Over at the forums.
Yeah, in the Honda Main Stage Forum, number 7, Dave Mack, the engineer, will be doing one at 1 o'clock today, 1 till 2.45. No, 2.15, sorry, 2.15, an hour and 15 minutes. And tomorrow morning, same place at 11:30, I'll be doing the final slot. And if I can just say one on behalf of us all, to say thank you not only to you guys, but to the organization, to everybody here who's looked after us, from the Mark Forson, particularly with the AAA, has done a fantastic job for us. And my quote family, unquote, in Oshkosh, who have given us the house, we had 8 of us in 4 rooms, like that, and shared bathroom. We've had an interesting few days. It's been absolutely brilliant.
Gentlemen, if you would please step up to the mic and identify yourselves, let your audience and your fans know who you are.
Well, I'll finish off then. I'm Tony Yule, known as the Adge, and I was a first officer on the fleet, 87 to 93. And thanks a lot, guys.
And Ian Smith here, first officer on the fleet for about 10 years, and enjoyed every minute of it. Thank you.
I'm Norman Britton, an ex-Navy pilot, so I've been supersonic, but only vertically before. And I've had a great time on the fleet for the 16 years or so I was there. And my fleet name, for some reason I can't understand, is The Animal.
I just want to know if it was the flight attendants that gave him the nickname or his fellow
crew. There it is. Red alert.
And several sheep in North Oxfordshire. And my name's Dave Rowland. I was a co-pilot and a captain on Concorde from 76 when it started to 99 when I retired.
And I'm the man from the second row, the best seat in the house, David MacDonald, the flight engineer, 74 to 94.
All right. Thank you guys for joining us.